This is a Fox News alert. I'm Joe Chiro. Authorities in central Italy say the number of dead from a magnitude 6.2 earthquake and aftershocks has risen to 120.
Children have been killed. Elderly have been killed. Thousands of people are left homeless, which is sort of the day two aspect of this story. And tent cities are being set up all around central Italy to try to accommodate them. People are walking around this town in tears. You see grown men and women absolutely traumatized that this beautiful city with its mountains and lakes, the town that for which the most famous pasta dish around Rome, Amatriciana, was named, is now gone forever.
Fox's Amy Kellogg. Hundreds of crews from across Italy and even the Vatican are arriving to help. At least one student was killed and more than a dozen wounded when gunmen attacked the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul.
Three independent sources tell Fox News the attack on the Afghan university is over. One woman at the university told me over the phone the attack was finished. A security sweep is currently underway, but local reports say that gunfire could still be heard. Two professors, including one American, at the school were kidnapped earlier this month. On Tuesday, a U.S. Army soldier was killed and one wounded in Helmand Province in southern Afghanistan. This week, the U.S. military ordered 100 additional American soldiers to Helmand to assist the Afghan army.
Fox's Lucas Tomlinson at the Pentagon. Vice President Joe Biden meeting with Turkey's leaders in Ankara. Biden's the first senior White House official to meet with the Turkish government since July's attempted coup. Biden saying U.S. support for Turkey is absolute and unwavering. Astronaut Jeffrey Williams now spending more time in space than any other American. 521 days in orbit today. His total accumulated over four missions. You're listening to Fox News Radio. Fair and balanced.
We're mixing business with politics to give you the bigger picture on Fox Business Network, featuring dynamic political programming that has more people tuning in than ever before. Special reports from the Team Viewers Trust, Bartiromo, Regan, Dobbs, and Cavuto. And from the debates right up to the election, expert insight and smart analysis you won't find anywhere else. For political coverage that's on the money, it's got to be Fox Business Network.
Your side has been desperately
wrong. He continues not to tell the truth.
He's got
to
be a
bad guy. All thing is a mess.
Let me make this point.
Nobody can justify this.
If I ask a question, I want an answer.
Another crazy school district.
Reaction from both sides.
What's the beef from the left?
Do you not see the danger?
Not a fact.
No.
That's
no,
what a pinhead says.
No BS, no fluff. Straight up facts.
Straight talking. Spin stopping. Calling out the pinheads and calling it like it is.
Please watch the O'Reilly Factor weeknights on the Fox News Channel.
Another case of locally acquired Zika virus has been diagnosed in Florida. Fox's Evan Brown is live in Miami.
And Joe, a new case of Zika identified in Palm Beach County, Florida. It's separate from the one found there earlier this month, according to Florida's Department of Health. This makes 43 cases of Zika in Florida, which the patient did not become infected overseas. Officials say transmission is happening in two spots of Miami-Dade County, and the CDC is warning pregnant women to delay travel to that area. The Federal Public Health Agency also announces today nearly $7 million more in grant money to partner agencies and territories and native tribal lands to help with Zika prevention. Joe.
Thanks, Evan. The mother of the so-called affluenza teen is no longer under house arrest.
A Texas judge releasing Tanya Couch from home confinement, but she's not completely free, still required to wear an electronic monitor. And though she's now a suburban Fort Worth bartender, she's not allowed to have alcohol or drugs as she awaits trial on charges of money laundering and hindering apprehension of a felon, her son Ethan. He used an affluenza defense to avoid jail time in a drunk driving crash that killed four people, but then ended up with a nearly two-year sentence after he and his mother fled to Mexico over a probation violation. Lisa Brady, Fox News.
Los Angeles authorities searching for two suspects wanted in connection with the kidnapping of three children. One suspect was related to Kimberly Harville, the mother of the children, who was found dead.
We believed that the sister, Brittany Humphrey, and acquaintance Joshua Robertson were with them, and we believe that they took the children sometime either before the murder or after the murder.
L.A. County Sheriff's Lieutenant Joe Mendoza, the mother, was found dead August 14th in some brush by a driver. The children are 2, 3, 5 years old. I'm Joe Chiro, Fox News Radio.
Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. Happy Wednesday to you. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today. We've got a really great, great show for you. Going to be talking about school construction in North Carolina. And a couple of members of the General Assembly will be joining us. Also, we will be talking with Mark Braden. He is formerly the Republican National Committee General Counsel, talking to him about voter fraud. And then we'll also be tackling the topic of a $15 per hour minimum wage. So lots of stuff to get to today. And we're going to remind you, first of all, though, that you can find us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC, at WhatMattersNC. And you can also tweet at me at Mark Shiver. So much going on. And while the General Assembly is not in session, there's still things that they are looking into and trying to make things better all across our state. And to help talk to us about that now and catch us up on what's going on, Representative Nelson Dollar, welcome to the program, sir.
Hey, Mark, it's good to be with you.
Well, we appreciate all the fine folks that you are representing in Wake County. We know you're doing a good job, and appreciate you taking time to join us here on the program today. So I was intrigued by an article that I saw, I think it was on WREL's website yesterday, talking about school construction. And it says that state lawmakers are spending $1 million to hire a firm to study school construction needs in all 100 North Carolina counties to obtain a clearer picture of what counties' needs are. And so why don't you tell us about that? What was the genesis of deciding to do this study in the first place?
Well, there are a number of legislators, and I think particularly among the rural legislators, Senator Brown has worked on this, as well as others who are concerned with the condition of schools, particularly in rural areas that are maxed out on their property tax base. In many cases, they're not growing that much, and they have significant school needs, and they know from for those kids, for those children, as well as for, you know, the economic future, that education is important. It's an important part of economic development. And so you want those kids to be able to have the same opportunities that those here in Wake and others have with respect to their school facilities. The question is, what's the actual condition of those school facilities? And, you know, what are the needs around the state? And, you know, you can look at that sort of thing and you can assume a lot, and there's some information that's out there, but I think that what we're looking to do in General Assembly is find out what the real problem is, you know, kind of strip away all that speculation and make sure we're working off actual data.
Well, our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina, Representative Nelson Dollar, representing folks in Wake County, and joining us here to talk about school construction and needs. One thing that kind of had me scratching my head, Representative Dollar, looking at something that I guess DPI put together, average cost of an elementary school, $41 million. I'm not a builder, but gee whiz, that sounds awfully high.
And I think that there's already a lot of discussion about, well, when we get the data, when we have a better, a more precise handle on what the problems are, what will the solutions be? Because the way our system is structured right now, the counties provide the facilities,
right,
the actual school buildings, and the state provides a good chunk of the operating cost and the main portion of the teacher salaries and administrator salaries. And that sort of division of labor has been out there for some time. And, you know, there's concern by some in the General Assembly that we don't want to take on, you know, the role of building all of the schools in the state. But at the same time, there may be some things that we can do to help, things that we can do to help them, for example, lower cost. And there are some counties that have done a tremendous job at lowering school construction costs. And frankly, others that have not.
Well, I think it's a worthy discussion and certainly something that definitely warrants looking into. I know As you've mentioned, there are so many counties in the state that are not like Wake or Mecklenburg or Guilford that, you know, have these large urban areas that can support with a broad tax base building the schools. Have you got a sense from any discussions that you've had so far? Do the poorer counties, for lack of a better word, do they want the state involved? And, you know, obviously there might be some strings attached to that, but do they want the state to come in and handle that, or are we still at the discussion stage?
Well, I think the, you know, the county commissioners for some time have pressed the state about, for example, they would like to receive a larger share of the lottery proceeds. Right now, the lottery provides $100 million annually to school construction needs. And as the bill was originally set up, that number, you know, would be higher than it is today. But during the recession and for other reasons, that figure was capped some time back. And so every year, you know, county commissioners will come to the General Assembly and say, look, we'd like a better share or a larger share of lottery proceeds for school construction. So it's very much on their minds. And, you know, there's also discussion, of course, anytime you're doing a statewide bond, like the one we just passed in March, there's discussion about whether or not we should provide statewide bond funding for local schools as well. And that has been done in the past.
Well, our guest, Representative Nelson Dollar here, as you go about, you know, you're the lead budget writer over there in the House, as you go about putting together a budget for the state, how, you know, we talk about teacher pay all the time, and that seems to be the squeaky wheel that gets the most attention, but there's so much involved with the schools that I guess people don't really think about. There's a lot involved. I guess you could say that, as you said, salaries and maintenance and, you know, upkeep and running these places, there's a lot to tackle, isn't there?
There's a lot to tackle. There's issues of teacher training, principal preparation. There are a number of programs that we have out there that we are have been working on the last several years to make our schools better. You know, it's more than just putting money in. It's how do you improve the performance of the schools? How do you improve student performance? Because if the students aren't learning, you know, whether the school is 3 years old or 30 years old or 60 years old, if the child is not learning, students not getting what they need to succeed in the economy, then, you know, the age of the building is sort of immaterial. And I think that at state level, we are all very, very cognizant that student performance has to remain the number one issue that we focus on, and everything that we do needs to be looked at is will this improve the outcome for students? Will this help students learn more, better, and what they need to succeed?
Well, that certainly is something that, you know, obviously has to be the top priority is performance. When you look at the disparity between, say, a Wake County and a Scotland County or a Onslow County, you know, the tax base is the gulf between the two is just huge. It may not be possible, Representative Dollar, for some of these counties to ever catch up to where they could afford to build a brand new school or, you know, renovate the ones that they have. Some of these counties are losing population, and it seems like kind of a vicious circle for some of these folks.
Well, and it's a mixed record as well, if you look at it. A number of the rural counties, you'd be surprised. I've driven through eastern North Carolina many, many occasions, and I've seen, even within the last month or two, you know, I've seen some schools that were clearly need to be replaced. And then in other areas down east, I've seen some brand new schools, some schools that have been renovated, that, you know, the local people have made that a priority and have done, an outstanding job. I do think that, you know, counties, I guess Scotland was pointed out, Jones County, you have some counties that right now are so, so poor and the population has been moving out, that you're absolutely right. We need to think maybe outside the box about how we can help them. You know, one of the issues that's come up, it's controversial, but, you know, maybe some of these counties need to join together, smaller counties that have lost population, and see if they can get some economy of scale across, you know, two or three county lines, and that would help them be able to afford what they need to afford for their students. But like I say, you know, that's, anytime you talk about that, that can be very controversial in a lot of areas.
Well, everybody wants to be in charge, I guess. That's just human nature. So that would be tough to pull off, I'm sure. So during the interim, as they call it, the time that you guys are not in session, this is just one of the things that is going on. When do you expect this study to be completed? Is this something that'll go to the folks at program evaluation, or will it go to a committee during the interim, or is it several months off before this study is completed? What's the timeline?
I really expect it to take at least a year to do the study correctly. And frankly, it may need a little more funding than what we've allocated for it at this point. I would anticipate that before the long session, we would have some, maybe an interim report or a very preliminary report that would be available to us, to at least to update us on where the project is. PED has been working very diligently over the last several months since General Assembly, you know, got out of town to try to put this together. It doesn't, on the surface, it doesn't seem like it's as complex as it is, but it is an incredible undertaking. And, I think it needs to be done. I think the state needs to have this data. They need to have it updated and in such a way that we do have a very clear picture and can understand what our financial situation is and then begin to see what we can do at the state level, to help out. Because again, you know, North Carolina has a lot of rural areas in it, a lot of low wealth areas. We already provide some additional funding for those school systems, for low wealth school systems, to offset the fact that you mentioned that counties like Wake, who have a lot of resources that a Scotland County, a Jones County will never have.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other end of this, too, I think as the discussion goes on, we will not lose track of the fact that counties like Wake, you know, our challenge is keeping up with all the folks that are coming in. I mean, our challenge is having to build a number of schools each and every year. So, you know, from my perspective as a legislator here in Wake County, I'm certainly going to want to make sure that we're addressing, you know, needs and concerns and issues with our school construction challenges here in Wake County.
Well, yeah, I guess that's the other side of the coin that doesn't really get talked about that as much when you start talking about school construction is, you know, we focus a little bit on the lower wealth counties, but the larger counties, Wake, Mecklenburg, and such, the population is just, as you said, increasing so quickly that the need for more schools doesn't slow down. Well, this is, I guess, what they'll look at then, Representative Dollar, is population and age of schools and condition of schools and growth and all of that, probably, right?
Yes, sir. I think they're gonna cover all of that. And I thought there was recognition in our budget discussions. The desire was to make sure that we could bring in a firm that would have maybe some additional capabilities to what we have in the General Assembly or what's available over at public instruction. You know, we wanted to get a fresh set of eyes and maybe some additional expertise and make sure, you know, we're getting a report that is based on the facts and, you know, isn't slanted because of, you know, someone's perspective, wherever they might be in state government. You know, an honest and in-depth assessment.
Well,
that way we can make the best policy decisions and make sure that whatever we do, we're going to be effective and we're going to be very wise with our limited tax dollars.
Well, it sounds like something that is going to take some time, but hopefully it'll come out and be, you know, informational and help you guys make good decisions to help you know, all of the schools across address all the school needs across the state. Thank you, Representative Dollar, for joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina. I appreciate your time as always and your insight, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure.
All right. Representative Nelson Dollar of Wake County, Chief Budget Writer in the North Carolina House of Representatives. And interesting topic, because if you take a, you know, hardcore conservative approach to this thing, you really don't want the state doling out a lot of money for school construction when that's always been the purview of counties and local government. And yet at the same time, you know, that hardball attitude doesn't take into consideration that the playing field isn't necessarily level in North Carolina when it comes to, you know, population and tax base and growth. And, you know, not to sound like Bernie Sanders here talking about unlevel playing fields, but the point is that this is a real challenge. You know, if you're up in, and we're going to talk with Senator McGinnis here in just a few minutes. He represents some of those smaller counties, those low-wealth counties, as they're called, up in the northwestern part of the state. And if you, you know, think about the reality that those folks face, people are leaving, the population is not growing, which, you know, on the one hand means that the need for new schools may not be as great, but, you know, the tax base is not very broad and it's not growing. And so just taking care of the existing schools that may have need for renovation and repair and all of that, is a real challenge for these folks. And so what do? You know, do you try to dole out more lottery money, specifically targeting the lower wealth counties? Do you make a larger appropriation to the these places in the general fund of the state budget? And it's not an easy topic. There's not an easy answer, particularly if you're trying to stay true to a conservative point of view. So this is an interesting conversation, and we appreciate Representative Nelson Dollar, always willing to come on the program. We appreciate him doing so today here on What Matters in North Carolina. So the campaign for president is in full force, as you know, and today Governor Pence is in the state. Seems like every week the Trump campaign is making some form of visit, whether it be the candidate Donald Trump himself or someone in his family. We know that Laura Trump was in Raleigh yesterday. Evelyn Woods over there at Briggs Hardware posting a couple of nice pictures of Laura Trump there. She visited. She was also with Lieutenant Governor Forrest's wife, Alice. And, you know, down in Brunswick County today, Vice President nominee Pence is there and making a speech. I believe he was in Charlotte earlier. So this just points, folks, to the reality that we are a significant state here in North Carolina when it comes to how the presidential election is going to pan out, how things are going to be determined in the end. Now, you know, if one of the candidates just blasts through and wins Florida and Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania and New York and Texas and California, and there's, you know, some of those states with large numbers of electoral votes, we may or may not be as much in the game, so to speak. But if the election is close at all, then North Carolina could be very, very, or will be, I won't say could be, will be very, very much in play as a state that could influence the outcome of the entire election. So we had hoped to have Governor Pence on the show today. That did not work out, so we'll keep working to get him and others from the campaign on what matters here in North Carolina. And I'm really excited to talk to Senator McGinnis in just a few minutes about this school construction issue. He has never been on the program, as far as I know, at least not with me. And so always glad to widen the net at the General Assembly and include more of those guys as guests on the program and find out what they have to say and get their perspective. Well, our own Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute, was quoted in an article, U.S. News and World Report, and it's at usnews.com, and it says, seeing red in North Carolina, and it says, the Tar Heel State has undergone a conservative makeover to the dismay of many of its residents. And, of course, this is written with a obvious leftist slant. Seth Klein is a staff writer here that wrote this, and he carries the distinction of being a producer at U.S. News and World Report. So he wrote this and talks about the conservative changes that have occurred in the state. And one of the reasons was quoted by Francis DeLuca, president of the Civitas Institute. He said voters in North Carolina who had always supported former Republican Senator Jesse Helms and voted Republican at the national level suddenly realized their local Democrats were no different from national Democrats. And so we've talked a couple of times with political experts that we have on the show, like Dr. Andy Taylor and David McLennan and others, who have said that, yes, the Democrats in the state have, you know, kind of looked at their national party platform and gone, whoa, you know, that's too liberal for me. And so they would maybe vote Republican for president and still, you know, locally vote for Democrats. But as Francis DeLuca of the Civitas Institute points out, that they're seeing Democrats locally now in the state adhering to or ascribing to that same kind of national platform liberal ideology. And we see people voting for Republicans in the state. And we see the General Assembly, as you know, in the 2010 election switched hands to a Republican majority for the first time in, you know, like 4,000 years or whatever it was. Well, maybe 100. But anyway, it's an interesting article if you can get through the bias. But he points out that there are 600,000 more registered Democrats than Republicans in the state. So you would expect maybe that there would be no competition. But as you know, the Republicans have been winning in the last three state, you know, elections for state house and state senate. And it looks like while they may or may not lose any seats regarding having a supermajority in this upcoming election in November, they are still, unless something just totally bizarre happens, expected to maintain the majority in this election as well. So, interesting article. Glad to see Francis DeLuca in a national forum there and making a very intelligent observation about voters in North Carolina. Well, on the other side, we'll have Senator Tom McGinnis, but first we'll get you caught up with your Fox News break. You are listening to the Freedom Action Network, What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver, and we will be right back.
We'll be right back.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Joe Chiro. An 80-year-old girl has just been pulled alive from the rubble after the earthquake that hit central Italy. At least 120 people are dead. The hardest hit town is Amatrice.
Many more may be injured. The mayor said that he was quite pleased with the emergency response team, it being August, the middle of the summer. This is a time when Italians are hard to reach, but they came from all over to these towns with their heavy equipment. And he said the equipment was sufficient, but the situation is still incredibly dire.
Fox's Kitty Logan in Italy. The 6.2 quake hit in the early morning hours. At least one person is believed dead and more than a dozen wounded after a militant attack on the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul.
We know that there was at least multiple attackers based on eyewitness accounts. Now, what we don't know is, was it a car bomb or a suicide bomb that sort of breached the outer walls, allowing these attackers to get in? But we have heard eyewitness accounts of attackers getting inside the American University of Afghanistan with rifles and shooting at people, also with suicide vests. We also understand from the Pentagon at this time that there are members of the NATO alliance on the ground there acting as advisors to the Afghan security forces. They are not taking part in what they say is a combat role.
Fox's Connor Powell. Donald Trump on the campaign trail, again reaching out to minority voters, saying he'll reduce crime.
I will fix it. I'll be able to make sure that when you walk down the street in your inner city or wherever you are, you're not going to be shot. Your child isn't going to be shot.
Trump at a rally in Tampa. He'll speak later in Jackson, Mississippi. Hillary Clinton continues her fundraising mission, making stops in California's Silicon Valley. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
The candidates are making their stands. The people are making their choice.
Record crowds, record votes.
This has been a crazy political season.
Education, immigration, healthcare, the economy, and our security. Our future hangs in the balance, and you need the facts.
Powerful reports, exclusive interviews.
Every angle covered, all of the fallout.
Powerful, fair, and balanced coverage.
No one can bring it to you like the Fox News Channel.
That's why we are most watched and most trusted. Fox Business Network gives you the edge from finance to politics. First, Maria Bartiromo and Stuart Varney get you ready for the opening bell.
Breaking news, busy morning this morning.
That's the stock to watch.
Then Neil Cavuto, Trish Regan, and Liz Claman watch the markets so you can make your move.
You're going to get more bang for the buck you're putting in.
And Charles Payne and Lou Dobbs have political coverage that's on the money.
And sending shockwaves around the globe.
Profit from experience when you watch Fox Business Network.
Vice President Joe Biden's in Turkey for a mission hoped to mend fences, but it found Biden on the defensive about the country's aborted coup in July.
This visit by Biden couldn't come at a time when relations between the U.S. and Turkey were any lower. They are both supporting the battle against ISIS, but they're also supporting different groups in that battle. Biden, who arrived this morning, was initially visiting Turkey to ease tensions in the aftermath of last month's coup, and was immediately forced to deny that the U.S. had any knowledge of it.
Fox's Benjamin Hall in London. President Erdogan repeated his demands that Washington extradite a religious leader currently living in the U.S. to try him for his role in the coup attempt. Scientists have discovered a planet that could have an Earth-like environment orbiting the star closest to our solar system. Fox's Grinnell Scott is live with more.
Joe, the international team of astronomers is saying this planet, slightly larger than Earth, has a rocky landscape from what they can tell and could possibly have water flows that could, in theory, sustain life. They say it's likely located in the nearest star system's Goldilocks zone, so named for being not too hot or cold, but just right. Scientists are thrilled about finding a planet so close, but close is a relative term in this case. You see, the planet is a little more than 4 light years away. That's about 25 trillion miles, Joe.
Thanks, Grinnell. The White House sidestepping commenting directly at Mylan's decision to raise the price of its severe allergy treatment drug, EpiPen. White House spokesman Josh Earnest suggesting Republicans are to blame.
All too often, it's Republicans in Congress who are standing up for pharmaceutical companies and not looking out for taxpayers and patients here in the United States.
Mylan's hiked prices on the allergy injection as frequently as 3 times a year over the past 9 years. Hillary Clinton and some lawmakers calling for an investigation accusing the company of price gouging. I'm Joe Chiro, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today on this Wednesday. And we're enjoying a little break from the humidity here in the Old North State. And nothing wrong with that. We'll take it. And so we've been talking today about school construction and costs and urban versus rural needs and a study that the General Assembly has commissioned to the tune of about $1 million, which will go through all 100 counties in the state and determine what the needs are for schools and school construction. And one of the people quoted in a WRAL article on this topic was Senator Tom McGinnis. He represents District 25, which is Anson, Richmond, Rowan, Scotland, and Stanley counties. Senator McGinnis, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. Hello. Well, I think his call dropped off, so we'll try to get him back on momentarily. And even in 2016, sometimes technology is a challenge. So anyway, while we're doing that, you know, as we talked with Representative Dollar in the 3 o'clock segment about school construction costs, we're looking forward to getting the perspective of a senator who represents some of those counties that do have some of the financial challenges and population challenges that we were talking about with Representative Dollar. So, Senator McGinnis, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Absolutely. Glad to be there, Mark.
Sorry about the phone situation there, but you know how technology is.
Well, it's wonderful when it works.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was telling the folks that listen to the program that you represent the folks up there in Anson and Richmond and Rowan and Scotland and Stanley counties, which just happen to some of the counties that don't have, you know, a big flush county budget to build new schools with.
You're correct.
So the General Assembly has commissioned a study to the tune of about $1 million to find out what the school construction needs are across the state. What are you, as a representative of those counties, again, which are not sitting on piles of cash, what are you hoping to see as a result of this study?
Well, number one, to finally bring light to the fact that that is a problem. And, you know, we're sitting here in a county such as Scotland with a $1.03 tax rate plus a solid waste fee, approximately $1,900 to $2,000 in local teacher supplements, one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates, one of the highest illiteracy rates, and the highest unemployment rate in the state. Well, these folks can't pay anymore. They're paying all they can pay. So again, we need to have that conversation. Go over to Stanley County, which is a tier two county. Scotland, Richmond, and Anson are tier one counties, but Stanley and Rowan are tier two counties. You've got a couple of schools in Stanley County that are, I think one of them is 80, parts of it are 80 years old.
Wow.
You know, we get to a safety issue. But the long and the short of it is, Mark, that in 1985, we established the tier system for economic prosperity and opportunity in North Carolina. And it was established to pick out the bottom 20 counties economically in North Carolina and bring incentives to those counties to entice folks to bring their jobs and their industries to those counties. Now here we are in 2016. The tier system's still here, but it's changed places because over 90% of the JDIG money, the Jobs Development Investment Grant money, incentive money, has been invested in Durham, Wake, and Mecklenburg County in the last 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
With very, very little of that invested in the tier one counties, which are the original need and reason for the establishment of the tier system. So we've lost our way in the General Assembly. It just didn't happen last week or last year. It happened 25 or 30 years ago. And we've lost our way. And now we see the error of our ways, that prosperity, economic development, poverty, joblessness, underemployment, unemployment, high tax rates. All these things run parallel with each other, and they all run with about 20 or 25, maybe 30 counties in North Carolina. So it's time to do something about it.
Well, our guest is Senator Tom McGinnis here on What Matters in North Carolina. And I guess that's the million-dollar question, Senator McGinnis, is what do we do about it? I mean, I'm sure the study is going to come back and show, yeah, there's a real need for schools in some of the lower wealth counties. But, you know, is the answer having the state take more of the general fund and send it specifically for school construction to some of those counties? Is it the lottery? Is there an easy answer?
Well, one of the easy answers is, and you just touched upon it, the lottery money for construction was basically cut in half by the previous governor's administration. And that money is money that's relatively certain that can be leveraged against debt to pay back a sum of money needed to build a new facility. One of the other challenges, Mark, that we have that's not been touched on is the declining student population in many of these rural counties. In my county of Richmond, we're short this year another approximately 60 or 70 students. We've been continually losing students for the last 10 years. So we were at over 8,000 just a few years ago. Now we're just a little over 7,600. So we've got excess capacity in old schools teaching less than 21st century opportunities and not teaching enough vocational and career path opportunities for those that are not going to college. So it's not a one size, one problem fits all situation. It's a myriad of things that need to be factored in, not just the new construction or the lack thereof.
Well, Senator McGinnis, you mentioned the job development investment grants and that sort of thing. You know, I guess there's a mixed feeling in even in among the Republican majority in the General Assembly about, you know, whether or not those things should be something that is utilized or utilized often or in a big way. And yet, as you said, when it is utilized, it typically goes to the larger urban areas, the tier three areas. So let's just for sake of hypothesis, let's just say that we're going to go all in with the job development investment grants and try to attract business to North Carolina. What can counties like yours in Richmond and Stanley and so forth, Scotland, what can they do to try to attract some of these larger business developments?
Well, go back again. Let's dig just a little deeper in the pile. We've got to have an educated workforce for the 21st century jobs that are available today. And our schools are doing as good as they can, but our community colleges have got to be invested with additional resources in order to teach 21st century skill sets and the skill sets that are needed for today's jobs. We've landed a couple of reasonably nice new industrial folks here in the last little while here in Richmond County, one 175 jobs, the other just under 100. But their average wage is about $30,000 to $32,000. So, you know, while that's a lot better than zero, it's not nearly as good as the average wage of those jobs for metropolitan life, which cost the state roughly $100 million in incentive money.
Wow.
To bring to Cary, North Carolina, and to bring to Ballantyne, the two most wealthy, most affluent zip codes in North Carolina. So, you know, we didn't have a chance at those because our workforce is not prepared for that type of job. But what our workforce is prepared for is welding and construction and electrical and plumbing and that sort of thing. And we just need to enhance our workforce with these 21st century opportunities. Raleigh has forgotten rural North Carolina on many fronts, and this is just one of them that we're speaking of today.
Well, I guess you're going to have to talk real loud in the Senate chamber, Senator McGinnis, to make sure they don't forget about the folks that you represent. We have seen a trend, at least I have. I used to work for Senator Tillman down there for several years, and we've seen a trend towards recognizing the value of a community college education. Is that something that you're really advocating for in your district, trying to get more focus on that in the community colleges that you have?
Absolutely. And what I'm most importantly advocating for is the widening and the broadening of the dual enrollment program that we have, where we have high school juniors and seniors that can go over to the community college campus, or the community college sends their professors to the high school to teach, again, 21st century learning opportunities in either pre-college or the vocational and the career path opportunities. And that's where our emphasis needs to be. When we have counties such as Richmond, Anson, and Scotland, where that have a rough average of only 15% of the people having a four-year degree or greater, it's pretty evident that 85% of them need to have some job skill that will allow them to earn a living wage. And so we've got to exemplify what we're doing on the community college level. Get back to the basics of the reason the community college was founded, and that is for vocational training and career path opportunities.
Our guest is Senator Tom McGinnis here on What Matters in North Carolina. We're talking about school construction and education needs in some of the counties that are not as affluent, particularly in District 25, Anson and Richmond, Rowan, Scotland, and Stanley. And a pure conservative view would not want to see the state load up the general fund with money to go all over the state to build schools. Traditionally, that has been left in the purview of the, you know, the local folks, the counties. And yet, can we avoid, Senator McGinnis, asking the state to play a larger role in some of the counties that don't have as broad of a population and tax base? Or is that like, you know, inviting something that we're trying to avoid at all cost?
Well, again, it's going to be not just school construction. It's going to be school consolidation. It's going to be redistricting of schools. It's going to be offering 21st century learning opportunities. And again, we've got overcapacity in many rural schools, underutilization, but in decrepit and antique buildings. So it's going to be a total mix, if you will, to create the positive outcome. You know, right now, we have counties in North Carolina that won't allow vocational or career path dual enrollment to be taught. The only thing they will allow is something for pre-college. You know, we've got to get the ability for dual enrollment to go down to the ninth and the 10th grade. If a kid is able, eligible, and willing to take those courses, to go ahead and get them on track. Why do we want to hold them back if they can go ahead and get out and start making a living wage? And again, we've got to bring the professors to the high school and make that happen, because the end result is, no matter how gleaming and beautiful the building is, if we're not offering the right courses in it, it's a moot point. But to go back to your question, we need to look at the counties that are in distress. There's about 20 of them. And basically, it's the same 20 that were in distress in 1985 when the tier system was created. And we need to understand what the problems are, and we need to try to fix it. Rather than putting a Band-Aid on it, we need to try to do a permanent fix. And if increasing for those counties the amount of lottery funding for construction so they can leverage that for new schools is what it takes, let's talk about it. But we need to have a long-range fix, and that's one of the things that I'm very disappointed that I've seen in Raleigh, and my view of Raleigh for the last 40 years is a long-range fix for a problem that continues to exasperate itself.
Well, certainly I know that your constituents are looking to you to represent them. Well, it sounds like you're doing just that and not letting the concerns of the folks that are, you know, putting their trust in you to represent them in Raleigh. It sounds like you are certainly remembering that and making their concerns known in the General Assembly, and I know that your constituents appreciate that. One thing I like to do, Senator McGinnis, with folks that come on that are in the General Assembly that are out there among the people, and as a senator, you hear from people in your district all the time. This is off topic, not necessarily about schools now, but just in general, what is the mood of the people in your district? Are they happy? Are they concerned? Are they doing all right? What do you get a sense that they're concerned with the most, particularly during this election season? Just give us a reading on the pulse of District 25, if you would.
Well, the majority of what people talk to me about is the ability to make a living wage, to support their family, to send their kids to college if they want to go, to own their own home, to have a retirement set up, and to have insurance, and to be able to, again, provide for their family. And until we remember that in Raleigh, that every zip code is not Ballantyne and Cary and Chapel Hill, but there are other zip codes in North Carolina that are not so prominent and not so well-to-do. And we've got to fix that, again, with leadership, not necessarily with money. You can only throw so much money at a problem unless you have leadership to make sure it is applied and you have measurable and accountable results for the transaction. And that's one of the things that we've got to understand and we've got to do as members of the General Assembly. These folks are asking for accountability. They're asking for measurable results, not do the same job over and over again and expect a different outcome, which we all know is the definition of insanity.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Senator McGinnis, thank you for your time. I hope that you will consider coming back on the program. We always enjoy talking to the folks in the General Assembly, and I appreciate your plain, ability to talk plainly and you know, tell it like it is for the folks that you represent. I appreciate that, and I know our listeners do as well.
Yes, sir. Mark, I appreciate you and appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. And I appreciate this conversation that we can have to go out to the listeners, because every day is not Sunday lunch and every night is not Saturday night supper in rural North Carolina.
I hear you.
And we've got to make sure that that's on the front burner when we come back in for the long session.
Well, I know you'll do just that. Thank you, Senator McGinnis. You have a great day.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Martin. Good day to you.
All right. Senator Tom McGinnis, first timer on What Matters in North Carolina, and sounds a bit fired up for the folks he represents. Well, you know, I can imagine that that would be frustrating to be a part of the General Assembly. And, you know, the old adage is that the rich get richer, right? So the Carys, the Chapel Hills, the Ashevilles, the Greensboros, the Raleighs, the Charlotte's, you know, big urban areas, they attract bigger businesses and, you know, the income is higher and the wheel goes round and round. And for folks in the district that he represents, it's tough. You know, you drive up there to the northeastern part of the state and you can tell it's very, very rural and they don't have the same type of industry or businesses or opportunities to make the kind of money that they do in the urban areas. And so this is a question that is not easily answered. You know, if you're Bernie Sanders, then you take all of Raleigh and Charlotte's money and divvy it up. But that's certainly not a realistic solution to anything. And I like his approach. You know, let's get as many kids as possible into the community college system where they can learn something that they can go out and make money with in a shorter period of time. A lot of these folks cannot afford to go to send their kids to a four-year college. So let's help these kids. And as he was talking about this program, let's let some of these juniors and seniors in high school go ahead and take community college classes and get on their way. Well, we had, as you recall, a guest not too long ago, I believe from the Pope Foundation, that was telling us that a nursing degree, a two-year nursing degree, average wage, or not wage, but salary, money made, whatever, income, is greater than those that have a four-year nursing degree. So there's no dishonor in going to a community college in 2016. And so this might be an answer, but golly, it's a long-term solution. But getting people into places where they can work and make money and spend more money and attract more business, you know, that's how the economy works. And so Senator McGinnis, I know, will not sit idly by and rest on his laurels in the General Assembly should he be reelected to another term. He's going to fight for his folks, and I know that they appreciate that very much. So we have an event that I would like to tell you about here on What Matters in North Carolina. The Civitas Institute is having a President's Club gathering, and this is really cool. Stephen Moore, the economist and distinguished visiting fellow from the Heritage Foundation, along with Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. This will be a luncheon on Tuesday, September 13th. He is also a senior economic advisor to Donald Trump and his campaign. And Stephen Moore, you've heard of him, I'm sure, but if you haven't, you don't want to miss this. Excellent, excellent economist. This is a luncheon presented by the Civitas President's Club. It is at the Park Alumni Center, which is at 2450 Alumni Drive in Raleigh. And it's Tuesday, September 13th, from 11:30 to 1:30. And so you can go to the Civitas Institute website and find out more information, nccivitas.org, and find out more information about this lunch with Stephen Moore, the economist. And again, very reputable, excellent, from the Heritage Foundation. And so you don't want to miss this, folks. This is going to be excellent. And of course, it's always a wonderful opportunity to speak with Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. So go to nccivitas.org for more information. You don't want to miss Stephen Moore. And hopefully we'll have him on the show too, by the way. So we'll get him on double duty. Get him at the luncheon and get him on What Matters in North Carolina. And that'll be great. I cannot wait to talk to Stephen Moore. All right, so coming up, we've got an interesting conversation, kind of in that money theme today. School construction costs, the economics of that. And our next guest has written an excellent, speaking of the Heritage Foundation, James Shirk is a research fellow in labor economics. And if you listened to yesterday, I was breaking down how businesses respond to government mandates and all of that. And if you missed that, you can go to freedomactionnetwork.com and download yesterday's show as a podcast. But James Shirk has written an interesting brief on how the $15 per hour minimum starting wage would affect each state. And it's well worth checking out at the Heritage Foundation website, heritage.org. But we're going to talk to him about that. And, you know, you hear a lot of people on the left saying that we need to pay people $15 an hour. That's somehow the magic dollar amount. And California and New York and others have begun to do this, and it's having an impact. And just like I mentioned to you yesterday, that it would have an impact, we're going to get an expert, James Shirk, here talking about how many jobs would actually be lost in North Carolina if there were a mandated $15 an hour wage. And I will tell you, folks, it's staggering. So stick around for a couple of minutes as we get Mr. Shirk lined up and ready to go. So before we leave the topic of school construction, though, I'm looking at these costs, and it's amazing. Year 2016, total costs $41 million. I guess this is, it says totals and average. There are two schools, $41 million. That's insane. I mean, folks, really? What in the world? Are they putting gold doors in these places? Gold commodes. That's what it is. Okay. All right. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina. You're on the Freedom Action Network. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening today. We're going to take a break for Fox News, and we will be right back.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Joe Chiro. An 80-year-old girl has just been pulled alive from the rubble after the earthquake that hit central Italy. At least 120 people are dead. The hardest-hit town is Amatrice.
Many more may be injured. The mayor said that he was quite pleased with the emergency response team, it being August, the middle of the summer. This is a time when Italians are hard to reach, but they came from all over to these towns with their heavy equipment, and he said the equipment was sufficient, but the situation is still incredibly dire.
Thanks, as Kitty Logan in Italy. The 6.2 quake hit in the early morning hours. At least one person is believed dead and more than a dozen wounded after a militant attack on the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul.
We know that there was at least multiple attackers based on eyewitness accounts. Now, what we don't know is, was it a car bomb or a suicide bomb that sort of breached the outer walls, allowing these attackers to get in? But we have heard eyewitness accounts of attackers getting inside the American University of Afghanistan with rifles and shooting at people, also with suicide vests. We also understand from the Pentagon at this time that there are members of the NATO alliance on the ground there, acting as advisors to the Afghan security forces. They are not taking part in what they say is a combat role.
Fox's Connor Powell. Donald Trump on the campaign trail, again reaching out to minority voters, saying he'll reduce crime.
I will fix it. I'll be able to make sure that when you walk down the street in your inner city or wherever you are, you're not going to be shot. Your child isn't going to be shot.
Trump at a rally in Tampa. He'll speak later in Jackson, Mississippi. Hillary Clinton continues her fundraising mission, making stops in California's Silicon Valley. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
The candidates are making their stands. The people are making their choice.
Record crowds, record votes.
This has been a crazy political season.
Education, immigration, healthcare, the economy, and our security. Our future hangs in the balance, and you need the facts.
Powerful reports, exclusive interviews.
Every angle covered, all of the fallout.
Powerful, fair, and balanced coverage.
No one can bring it to you like the Fox News Channel.
That's why we are most watched and most trusted. Fox Business Network gives you the edge from finance to politics. First, Maria Bartiromo and Stuart Varney get you ready for the opening bell.
Breaking news, busy morning this morning.
That's the stock to watch.
Then Neil Cavuto, Trish Regan, and Liz Claman watch the markets so you can make your move.
You're going to get more bang for the buck you're putting in.
And Charles Payne and Lou Dobbs have political coverage that's on the money.
Sending shockwaves around the globe.
Profit from experience when you watch Fox Business Network.
Vice President Joe Biden's in Turkey for a mission hoped to mend fences, but it found Biden on the defensive about the country's aborted coup in July.
This visit by Biden couldn't come at a time when relations between the U.S. and Turkey were any lower. They are both supporting the battle against ISIS, but they're also supporting different groups in that battle. Biden, who arrived this morning, was initially visiting Turkey to ease tensions in the aftermath of last month's coup, and was immediately forced to deny that the U.S. had any knowledge of it.
Fox's Benjamin Hall in London. President Erdogan repeated his demands that Washington extradite a religious leader currently living in the U.S. to try him for his role in the coup attempt. Scientists have discovered a planet that could have an Earth-like environment orbiting the star closest to our solar system. Fox's Gernal Scott is live with more.
Joe, the international team of astronomers is saying this planet, slightly larger than Earth, has a rocky landscape from what they can tell and could possibly have water flows that could, in theory, sustain life. They say it's likely located in the nearest star system's Goldilocks zone, so named for being not too hot or cold, but just right. Scientists are thrilled about finding a planet so close, but close is a relative term in this case. You see, the planet is a little more than 4 light years away. That's about 25 trillion miles, Joe.
Thanks, Grinnell. The White House sidestepping commenting directly at Mylan's decision to raise the price of its severe allergy treatment drug, EpiPen. White House spokesman Josh Earnest suggesting Republicans are to blame.
All too often, it's Republicans in Congress who are standing up for pharmaceutical companies and not looking out for taxpayers and patients here in the United States.
Mylan's hiked prices on the allergy injection as frequently as three times a year over the past 9 years. Hillary Clinton and some lawmakers calling for an investigation accusing the company of price gouging. I'm Joe Chiro, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you with us as we race through another program. And you can follow us on Twitter at What Matters NC. You can tweet at me at Mark Shiver. We had a great first hour talking about school construction costs and needs in North Carolina and the disparity between the larger, more urban counties like Wake, Mecklenburg, where Raleigh and Charlotte are, and some of these poorer, low-wealth counties that just don't have the population or the property tax base. So the General Assembly has commissioned a study, and we'll keep you up to date on the results of that and how to solve a problem that really doesn't have an easy solution. But we appreciate Representative Nelson Dollar and Senator Tom McGinnis coming on the program and talking about that very important issue here in North Carolina. Now, another issue that we have heard a lot about, especially as folks were feeling the burn for a while, was income inequality and wage disparity. And it became very much in vogue somehow. I don't know where the number 15 came from, but paying folks a $15 per hour minimum starting wage became the solution to everybody's problems. And some states have gone ahead and done that. I think some businesses have gone ahead and done that, and they're finding out now that it's not as easy as it sounds on paper. And James Shirk is an excellent research fellow in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation, and he's written a very excellent piece, how $15 per hour minimum starting wages would affect each state. And he is our guest now here on What Matters in North Carolina. James Shirk, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's our pleasure, and certainly this issue brief that you put together for the Heritage Foundation is very well written, very well thought out, and written in such a way that I can understand it. And I went to school in South Carolina, so that's saying a lot. So well done, sir.
thank you, I think.
Well, let's just dive right in. First of all, where did the number 15 come from? Why is that the magic minimum wage number? Why not 12, 50, or 16?
Because it's a catchy slogan, fight for 15.
Okay.
I wish it were actual serious economic analysis, but the union that's been pushing all this, the Service Employees International Union, initially they were pushing 10-10 an hour because that sounded catchy, particularly when they were pushing it in 2010. And then they decided that wasn't catchy enough, and fight for 15 became their new slogan. I think that a lot of people thought that this was just, you know, them being sort of overly ambitious, sort of a stretch goal. If we say we want 15, that'll make $10, you know, seem a lot more reasonable. But it seems that the union does, in fact, they've got California and New York State and a number of cities, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and others to, you know, require all businesses to pay starting wages of $15 an hour. I think this is going to hurt a lot of workers, but it's gone from being a slogan to being something that policymakers have taken seriously without the actual economic analysis ever being done in between.
Well, our guest, James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation. So I was talking yesterday with our listeners about how businesses respond to government intervention and regulation and mandates, which obviously this minimum wage would fall under that category. And in your excellent article here, they do basically what I was describing, only you describe it a lot better. They are not going to just, you know, fold up the tent. They're going to adapt. And often that means cutting their workforce.
No, that's exactly right. When the price of something goes up, you know, when gas becomes more expensive or food becomes, you know, more expensive or whatever it is becomes more expensive, very well-established principle in economics and in common sense that people buy less of it. Somehow, a lot of these activists seem to think that that somehow magically doesn't apply to hiring workers. But what happens when wages rise at a business? Well, they can either cut back on the number of workers they're hiring, in which case they're directly reducing their payroll count on their workforce, or they can say, all right, we're going to pass this along to our customers. We're going to we've got higher costs. Let's just pass along to our customers and we'll raise prices. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, that's where all the money a business has comes from. It comes from customers voluntarily purchasing their products. So what happens if they raise the prices? Well, they're going to sell less. You raise prices, they're going to sell less. And because they're selling less, they're going to need fewer workers to make whatever it is they're making. So whether the company simply decides to automate directly or respond in ways where they're directly cutting back on labor, or if they raise prices, as a consequence of those price increases, they're going to need fewer workers. Either way, you're going to be left with fewer workers at the end of the day.
And, I think our guest James Shirk here of the Heritage Foundation, certainly these union people are not stupid. They know the adverse effects that doing this is going to have on business. But apparently they either they don't care or they're so blinded by their vigorous intent to help their workers that they just really don't pay attention to the adverse effects.
Well, you're certainly right that they understand how much this is going to hurt businesses. And we know this because they don't want it to apply to them. There's just hilarious news articles coming out of Richmond, Virginia, where the Fight for 15 movement had an annual, basically get-together conference of all sorts of people saying we need $15 an hour. And they're being protested by the Fight for 15 staff that the Service Employees International Union had hired to push for these campaigns. And the staff were protesting on the basis that the SEIU was not allowing them to form a union and that SEIU wasn't paying them $15 an hour. So the very union who is hiring workers to say that the only fair thing in life is if you have $15 an hour at least in a union does not want its own staff to unionize and is not paying them $15 an hour. So I think it's pretty clear that the unions understand full well just how harmful this would be to businesses because they certainly think it would harm them if they had to do it. But why are they pushing this? Well, I think it's because, for the most part, unionized businesses are not the ones hiring the very entry-level workers and the inexperienced workers just entering the workforce. Unionized businesses and union members tend to be more moderately skilled. They tend to be in that $15 an hour range to begin with. So requiring every business to pay $15 starting wages makes their competition more expensive. It makes it more difficult for businesses to hire the less skilled workers that the union compete against. It's a way, basically, for the union to make it more expensive to compete against them. I mean, you've had initiatives in California where the unions have been pushing to say you've got to pay at least $15 an hour in the hotel industry. And the union said openly in the press that this was about raising costs for the non-union hotels so that the unionized hotels wouldn't be at a disadvantage. I think to a large extent that's what SEIU is trying to do, raise costs for their competitors so that the union isn't at a disadvantage. The fact that that would cost a lot of jobs is to the union a secondary concern.
Well, and that really is disturbing to think about, what little concern they really would have about the lives that would be impacted by lost jobs, let's hit our goal here, but the heck with people who suffer as a result. That doesn't seem to be very much demonstrating a real care and concern for the rank and file on the part of the unions.
Well, it's, I estimated the nationwide effect if every state raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And it would be about 9 million fewer jobs nationwide. In North Carolina, you'd have about 367,000 fewer jobs by 2021 if they took starting wages to $15 an hour by then.
Is that federal mandate or a state mandate?
That would be if you had a state minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. That would cost about 360,000 jobs in North Carolina. That's a lot of people.
Yes, it is.
360,000 people is an enormous number of people who would just find that they couldn't find work, that nobody would be willing to hire them at that rate. Because, again, remember, why do companies hire workers? Generally, it's not as a charity project. A company will hire a worker when the additional money that having that worker on the payroll that they bring in is greater than the cost of hiring that worker. Well, if you have a $15 an hour required starting wage, the company also has to pay payroll taxes on that. They have to pay unemployment insurance taxes. They either have to provide qualifying Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, health care benefits, or they have to pay a penalty on that. So $15 an hour wages is, from the employer's point of view, a minimum full-time hiring cost of $18.61 an hour. So that policy is basically saying anyone who produces less than $18.61 an hour in value for an employer cannot work. The companies would lose money by hiring you. Well, there's an awful lot of workers who are simply going to find that they're not that productive for their firms. Yeah, I had a minimum wage job when I was in high school. I'm pretty sure I was not worth $18.60 an hour or worth the value to my employer. Maybe they thought I was, but yeah, I highly doubt that. You know, that's true of a lot of teenage workers. It's true of a lot of workers on their first job. If you set minimum starting wages that high, you're just going to make a lot of workers unemployable, especially those with less experience and less skills.
Well, that's really incredible when you stop and think about 360,000 jobs here in North Carolina, if they were to start that now. Fortunately, I guess they haven't done that, and there's no real impetus here in North Carolina to move in that direction. But some of these places, tell us some of the horror stories, or so to speak, that we're finding out, like in California and New York, that things aren't as rosy with this as they seem.
Oh, we're starting to see it already. I mean, you're getting stories out of the cities that have passed this. There was a longtime diner in Chicago, or sorry, in New York. They just recently announced that they weren't going to be able to absorb this. They couldn't raise the prices that high, and you know, the consumers just weren't going to buy a burger. It would be like a 25% price increase, and they just said, you know, like, our consumers aren't going to pay us $9 for this burger. We just, we can't afford it. We can see that we're going to go under, and so, you know, they pulled the plug now. And another pretty high-profile story is coming out of Los Angeles, where American Apparel is one of the few garment clothing manufacturers left in the United States. A lot of that work has gone overseas, but they're one of the few that have a number of workers in Los Angeles. And their starting wages are below $15 an hour. But actually, with the performance incentives, the more experienced workers, some of them do get above $15 an hour. But Los Angeles, when they passed the minimum wage hike, the company just looked at the numbers and said, we cannot afford to pay $15 an hour starting wages to everyone, no matter their productivity. And so the company shut down 500 jobs in Los Angeles. And the news reports at the time were that they were going to relocate them to another city within California. Well, then California raised the statewide minimum wage, and it's going to phase into $15 an hour. And the news reports are now is that American Apparel is going to move those jobs entirely out of the state. 500 jobs entirely gone from California, and they're looking at elsewhere in the U.S. for now. But, of course, if you had a federal minimum wage of $15 an hour, they'd be looking at a different country.
Yeah, absolutely. No thought about moving down the road, but maybe moving across the ocean. Our guest, James Shirk, excellent labor economist with the Heritage Foundation, joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina. So do you see momentum, James, that this might take the country by storm, or would this be a state-by-state thing? Is there a movement in Congress for a federal mandate? Where do we stand on all this?
Well, there has been legislation introduced by Senator Sanders, independent socialist, self-identified socialist from Vermont, obviously, came very close to getting the Democratic presidential nomination. You've had some fairly prominent Democratic senators actually have endorsed this, the Assistant Minority Leader Dick Durbin from Illinois. I think, though, that it's unlikely to happen at the federal level. I think saner voices on the left recognize that this would be a disaster. And I think, though, that you're calling about taking the country by storm. I think it could do that, but not in the way activists think. We are going to get out of California and out of New York and out of these cities that have gone up to $15 an hour pretty clear economic evidence about what happens when you raise your starting wages to cover one-third of the workforce. And I think it's not going to be pretty. I think the American Apparel evacuating California is just the sort of the the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. I think we're going to see enormous damage to the economy of California, particularly once you get outside of Silicon Valley and the really high living cost areas where the wages were higher to begin with. If you start looking at inland California and rural California, this is just going to be, it's going to be like a nuclear bomb dropping on many of these localities' economies. So I think what we're going to see is California and New York are going to be an object lesson for why this is a horrible public policy, and other states and cities are going to look at that and say, that's not a good idea. Let's never do this.
While I have you, let me ask you this. It's not off topic, but it is not enclosed in the body of your article. But one of the things that Senator Sanders ran on, which seemed to catch momentum or traction with some of his constituency, was this notion of income inequality. Now, I don't agree with that at all. But that being said, there are people out there, James, that can't make ends meet. I mean, if minimum wage is seven, whatever it is now, you can't live on that. And what are these people to do? I mean, there's no easy answer here.
Well, I think that there's certainly a lot of very important, very valid points that are made about, it's expensive to live. Living costs are high in a lot of places in the country. A lot of these activists are making a pretty heartfelt pleas for, why $7.25 an hour, isn't cutting it for them. Now, not many people are trying to live on the federal minimum wage, but if you were trying to do that, it would be hard. But the way to help these people is not by pricing them out of the labor market. What you ought to do is directly address the factors that are making it so expensive to live in the first place. One of my colleagues, Salim Firth, had a great report that he put out last year discussing how we could make housing and renting somewhere to live a lot less expensive if we relax some of these very restrictive zoning laws. Housing is just unnecessarily expensive for most middle-class and lower-income families these days, and they could save thousands of dollars a year if we had more sensible zoning policies that didn't make it so difficult to basically expand the housing supply in many of these cities. Things like occupational licensing laws that are both raising the prices of goods and services sold and freezing many workers out of jobs where they could earn a better living than what they have now. Certainly for a job like a pharmacist or a surgeon, it makes sense to be licensed. But why is every state in the country licensing barbers? It appears to be mostly protectionism. And mostly a way to sort of freeze out workers from the field and stop them from competing. Well, you'd have lower prices and you'd have better job opportunities if you rolled back some of those unnecessary licensing things. A lot of our federal agricultural policy just makes food a lot more expensive than it needs to be. The ethanol mandate, we're taking basically 40% of the U.S. corn crop and turning it into an environmentally harmful fuel additive that makes gasoline more expensive and makes food more expensive. The better way to help people who are struggling is to go directly at the problem of high living costs. We can make food more affordable. We can make housing more affordable. We can make cars more affordable if we relax these CAFE standards that have added about $7,000 to the cost of a new car in recent years. We can make it more affordable to live without pricing less skilled workers out of the job market and preventing them from earning anything in the first place.
Well, I guess, I agree completely with everything you just said. The little anecdote for you, you may know this, but here in North Carolina, we have 700 occupations that require a license. Now that is
good grief.
That's absurd.
No, it's ridiculous.
So African hair braiding is always the one that stands out as making people scratch their head, along with auctioneers and librarians. So that's a whole nother topic that certainly you mentioned that it is designed to keep people basically out of competition, existing companies or industries, businesses, fields want to keep people out. So they have lobbied for these licenses. And certainly that would help if people could, get into these things and exercise some of the entrepreneurial spirit that has made America great without having to jump through all of these hoops. So, appreciate your insight on that. So, in terms of, and I'm not going to ask you to, endorse anybody, obviously, but who do you think better understands this issue of the minimum wage? Is it Hillary Clinton, from what you've heard of her economic policy, or Donald Trump and what he's talked about? Or have either of them mentioned the minimum wage?
You know, I'm just going to steer wide clear of that. We are a C3 organization and you know, nonpartisan think tank. And yeah, I'm just going to steer wide clear of that.
Okay.
yeah.
Well, certainly respect that. And we respect all of your excellent work at the Heritage Foundation. James Shirk, thank you for joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina, and we'll look forward to having you again soon. Thank you, sir.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Well, was not asking him to endorse, but comment on policy. Anyway, I understand. So $15 minimum wage, according to James Shirk, not very viable. And as we talked about yesterday, and as he reiterated today, very possibly just run a lot of people out of business, because businesses are going to adapt. They're going to have to do to make a profit. Or like this business in New York he talked about, they're just going to close their doors and say, look, I can't hang, can't do it. And then, you know, you got your minimum wage, but you got no employees to pay it to. And it's interesting how these unions, it's kind of like the Moral Monday people, you know, they roll in all these people from out of town. They don't really care about people. They're trying to focus more on, you know, hey, look at me. Look at me. You know, this is our group. Look what we're doing. We don't really care about the people. We just want the spotlight to be on us. And that's the way these unions are seem to be operating, according to what Mr. Shirk was saying, that they don't really care about the people. We may lose jobs here, but oh well, we're the union. Look what we did. So anyway, and they know good and well the negative impact of what this type of thing will do when you mandate a minimum wage like that. That's almost double, or maybe more than double, what the federal minimum wage is currently. So we appreciate James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina. And, you know, going back to school construction costs, you know, what if you're a business in one of these counties that Senator McGinnis was talking about that he represents that are struggling, Anson or Richmond or Rowan or Scotland or Stanley, you know, low population to begin with, and people, their median income is not nearly as great as it is in Charlotte or Raleigh. And all of a sudden you're asking the local fast food place to pay its employees, to mandate that they pay their employees $15 an hour. And so that burger that was, you know, $1.79 is now $2.98. And people are going, well, heck, I can't afford that. I'm going to stay at home. And next thing you know, the restaurant is laying off employees and closing their doors. I mean, it's really short-sighted. Yes, it's a great soundbite. Yes, it helps somebody like Bernie Sanders gain a lot of traction talking about income inequality and, you know, his ads about Wall Street, which I never understood that. That was the big bailout. He was talking about that. That was, you know, who even remembers that? And so I'm not sure who put his campaign ads together, but his whole point was, you know, the government needs to make these things happen, level the playing field for people, which goes against the American spirit. The American spirit says, go out and work hard and have a vision and do what you can, and you'll be rewarded for it. Not everybody, obviously, is going to, you know, end up being a billionaire like Donald Trump. But you certainly don't want the government making demands on outrageously high or unreasonably high, unrealistically high minimum wage dollar amounts. And I agree with James Shirk completely. We need to give people opportunities to succeed. And loosening a lot of these regulations that he talked about is certainly a good place to start. The only problem is, as we've talked about before, these regulations are hard to undo. Bureaucracy is hard to unwind. It's hard to shrinking or to make smaller. Once you get a government program in place, it's almost impossible to remove it. It's just the nature of the beast. And why? Because the number one concern of an elected official, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, otherwise, is getting reelected. And so when you talk about doing away with government programs, then you might make somebody mad and you might not get reelected, and the bureaucracy continues to grow and grow and grow. And that's Politics 101, folks. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina here on the Freedom Action Network. We're going to take a break, get you caught up with Fox News, and then we'll talk with Mark Brayden. He is the former general counsel for the Republican National Committee. We're going to talk some voter fraud here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Fox News Radio, I'm Joe Chiro. Central Italy still reeling from a 6.2 magnitude earthquake that struck early this morning, killing at least 120 people. Fox's John Huddy is in the hard-hit city of Amatrice amid the search for survivors.
It's so tight. It's up. It's built along the hillside. So getting heavy equipment in here is very difficult. So they've been using some of the more smaller excavators and backhoes to get in here, and then using shovels, digging by hand. And that has been a constant. The military, the army is here helping. Any and all local and regional-wide search crews, rescue teams, and ambulance, police, they are all here on the scene trying to help in any way possible. It is a dramatic scene. It's an ongoing scene as the search for life here continues.
An 8-year-old girl was pulled from the rubble alive after spending more than 17 hours buried in the debris. Tense moments in Afghanistan after the American University in the capital of Kabul was under siege by a militant attack. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest.
The fighting has, at least the shooting has stopped. For the time being, but there's still ongoing efforts to ensure that the situation has been resolved.
Afghan officials say one person was killed, 14 wounded, including a professor. Vice President Joe Biden on a fence-mending trip to Turkey and denying any U.S. involvement in the coup attempt there in July.
Can you imagine us being happy with another military state? We didn't get on so well with your previous military states. So what motive could we possibly have? None.
The Turkey's government's repeatedly asked for the extradition of a Turkish cleric currently living in Pennsylvania to try him for his role in the coup attempt. You're listening to Fox News Radio. Fair and balanced.
We're mixing business with politics to give you the bigger picture on Fox Business Network, featuring dynamic political programming that has more people tuning in than ever before. Special reports from the team viewers trust, Bartiromo, Regan, Dobbs, and Cavuto. And from the debates right up to the election, expert insight and smart analysis you won't find anywhere else. For political coverage that's on the money, it's got to be Fox Business Network.
There's a reason why more Americans are watching Fox News Channel. Every breaking report.
We have uncovered new leads on the gunman's ugly motive.
The city in mourning. People in shock.
ISIS is claiming responsibility for that attack.
Every story that matters.
This is a historic night in American politics.
America's leaders are calling for people to come together.
And every angle covered.
Politicians will never tell you that.
Always fair, balanced, and unafraid. Most trusted, most watched on all of cable. Only Fox News Channel.
Wildfires prompting more evacuation orders in California and keeping tourists away from national parks in Wyoming. Fox's Jessica Rosenthal is live in L.A.
Joe, the fire in San Luis Obispo County, California, keeps growing. It's burned 45 homes now and several other structures. Now, a fire near Grand Teton National Park has closed one of the roads to Yellowstone, where a handful of fires are burning inside that park. More firefighters are headed to the area. Multiple fires have burned up in Washington state and have prompted the governor to declare a state of emergency. Jeff Seveny is an information officer on a complex of fires outside of Spokane, which burned 10 homes.
We had really some extreme weather conditions, red flag warnings in the area with high temperatures, low humidity, with strong gusty winds.
Though now he says the weather is a bit better, and at least this fire has calmed down, Joe.
Thanks, Jessica. A Mississippi man who tried to travel to Syria with his fiancée to join ISIS has been sentenced to 8 years in prison on federal terrorism charges. The fiancée was sentenced earlier to 12 years. Chaos last night in a San Francisco neighborhood.
Witnesses describe it as a runaway taxi that skipped the curb last night on San Francisco's busy Market Street, plowing through a kiosk, a shoeshine stand, and two people who worked there.
I seen the old man in the air falling in.
that's when everybody started rushing, and I thought it was like, you know, a bomb or something.
Three people, including the taxi driver, were rushed to a hospital as investigators speak to witnesses and check security cameras to see if the cab ran a traffic light or was speeding. Jeff Manasso, Fox News.
It's the first day of classes at the University of Texas, a little more than 3 weeks after new state law took effect that allows concealed handguns in classrooms and dorms. Hundreds of students protested the law today by waving sex toys in the air at a campus rally. I'm Joe Chiro, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today. We've talked about a couple of issues, primarily economic in nature. We talked about school construction costs here in North Carolina. We also talked about mandating a minimum wage of $15 an hour and what kind of impact that would have on the states. And James Shirk of the Heritage Foundation said, if you did that in North Carolina now, it would have the effect of, by 2021, costing 360,000 jobs. And so that's a lot, and it's something to think about. But anyway, we've been also talking here a lot on the show, as you know, of late, about the Fourth Circuit three-judge panel that struck down the voter reform legislation, which included as its centerpiece voter ID, which most people in North Carolina still support. They supported it when the law was passed, and they support it now, even though this panel has struck it down. And it was interesting because I like to look at newsbusters, and there was a clip that showed former Republican National Committee General Counsel Mark Braden just shredding this anchor, Tamron Hall, who was saying that there is no voter fraud, and he basically dispatched with that notion pretty easily. So I reached out to Mr. Braden and would like to welcome him now to What Matters in North Carolina.
Good afternoon.
How are you, sir?
It's a beautiful day in D.C., so I'm doing well.
Well, let's get right to it. First of all, you held your own there on MSNBC, so tip of the hat for you there, sir.
Oh, well, thank you. I have to admit it was a bit of a hanging curveball. It's a subject I've dealt with a lot, so it's not too hard for me to talk about.
Well, we always hear this. There's no such thing as voter fraud. And it's a tough thing to answer because if you say, yes, there is, then the immediate response to that is, well, prove it. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it's hard to prove. You know, here in North Carolina, there have been some cases that have come before the State Board of Elections, but as I think it's easier to commit than it is easier to catch.
Well, yes, no question about it. You know, our system does work pretty well. And on the whole, our elections are well run and are fairly counted, and the winners win and the losers lose. But there are occasions where it doesn't happen, and most of it occurs in the context of absentee balloting and collusion of poll workers, when you have elections conducted in places where there aren't really two parties operating and you don't have people watching other people, then people do what people do, which is they take advantage of the situation and they sometimes cheat. So it works, but there are been plenty of prosecutions and also plenty of evidence of vote fraud that doesn't get prosecuted. I spent really more than 20 years as the outside counsel to the House Administration Committee doing election contests and recounts, and we would, on occasion, when we do an election contest or a recount, stumble upon illegal votes. And it's not hen's teeth. It's not common, but it most certainly occurs, and occasionally elections are affected by it.
Our guest, Mark Braden, former general counsel to the Republican National Committee. He's an attorney in Washington, D.C., joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina. You made an interesting point. I'm looking at an article here online from a couple of years, about a year and a half ago. And in North Carolina, the State Board of Elections basically dismissed two or three cases that came before them, basically not seeming to really want to dive down and get into this whole thing and investigate. And so I think that what we have oftentimes is that either the State Board of Elections or County Board of Elections are not set up to investigate, or they just don't want to be bothered.
Well, it's a little bit of both. And let's be candid, especially in those places where you have a one-party system, where you don't have two active people watching each other, there's not much of an incentive to prosecute. In most of those locations, the prosecutors are elected by the same process they're being asked to investigate. There's not a whole lot of incentive to investigate a process by which you got your job.
So, yeah,
so I'm
exactly.
It's not shocking that people don't go forward and investigate these. People just, you know, it should not be surprising that people act the way they do when the opportunities arise, especially when you have the elections that we have now, where each side, both Republicans and Democrats, look at the other candidates and say that they're the Antichrist, that they believe that the stakes are so high that cheating would justify, any means justify the particular ends of defeating this candidate. So you see those circumstances, although frankly the most common circumstance are people trying to preserve their jobs or working for a particular machine operation, or frankly they're working on a ballot issue, you know, liquor by the drink or opening up a casino or something like that. Those are the type of economic incentives involved in the process that bring out cheating.
Well, I hadn't thought about that, issue-oriented cheating. I guess that's a whole other ball of wax. Our guest here is Mark Braden, who, if you haven't seen it, go to Newsbusters, and his appearance there on MSNBC with Tamron Hall. Basically, I think she was feeling like she needed to take a break after her encounter with Mr. Braden here. So I remember, and this goes back to 30 years ago almost, in South Carolina, I was working on a campaign, and actually in the precinct, I was watching, just observing, and the candidate that we were in opposition with, he had people there at the table as elderly folks would come up, and they would put what they called palm tickets in their hand, and it had on there who they were supposed to vote for. And if this weren't bad enough, that I saw them escort these elderly people behind the curtain and go in there and actually vote for them. It was unbelievable. And this was in the 1980s, so certainly this has not changed. And for people that don't think there's voter fraud, I think they, you know, they're just fooling themselves.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure I understand why people would think that it wouldn't be voter fraud. People do commit crimes. There are economic consequences to elections at the local level, in some cases very direct economic consequences. You mentioned South Carolina. I won't be too specific, but it wasn't that many years ago in South Carolina. There was a dispute. There was over an election involving liquor by the drink in a South Carolina county that was, shall we say, right on the border with North Carolina. Maybe people will remember this incident, where somebody owned a large facility there, and somehow or another, that large facility was able to get a number of people voting absentee who apparently didn't exist, so liquor by the drink would pass. So that's the type of thing that happens in the process. Again, I don't want to be Chicken Little and say the sky is falling, because the vast majority of our election officials are honest, and the vast majority of our elections are totally fair and honest. But, I mean, to get in a dispute over people identifying themselves to vote seems to me to be a somewhat silly situation. I mean, people have to identify themselves for all types of things, and the vast, vast majority of Western-style democracies require people to identify themselves with some type of ID when they vote. So this is really not much of an imposition on people.
Well, let's talk about that, Mr. Braden. Here in North Carolina, we had a widely supported voter ID legislation, and a three-judge panel, as you know, in the Fourth Circuit, struck it down, and they made accusations of, you know, blatant racism, and, you know, saying that the whole thing was put together with racist intent. They didn't prove that. They just made that allegation, and people here support that. People want to know that there's integrity in their elections, and it's very disconcerting to have judicial activism on this level where they are going against the will of the majority of people in a state to try ensure fair elections in the name of, well, you're suppressing the vote, which is an outrageous allegation in the first place.
Yeah, I read the opinion, and I have to admit I was in fact shocked by the opinion. First of all, let me just say, it seems to me that there should be much more outrage over the fact that there might be people out there who want to have IDs and can't get them. So why somebody would be concerned about people not being able to vote? The concern should be over, well, geez, if these people want to vote, they should be able to get an ID. And my understanding in North Carolina, the process is open and available. So people should be concerned because people who don't have IDs, frankly, can't access many of the needs that they should get from government, access to government services, many accesses to normal life. So the concern shouldn't be over whether or not people can vote. The concern should be why these people don't have IDs, and people should be working to get them IDs rather than being concerned about imposing some type of ID requirement for voting, which is pretty simple and straightforward. It's possible to create an ID process that would be unfair. But I see nothing in the record in North Carolina to indicate it's an unfair process. It seems to be readily available to people, and there most certainly are options available to make it accessible to anyone who wants an ID. And we should want everyone who wants an ID to be able to get it, and we should be concerned about that rather than be concerned about requiring people to have IDs to vote. It's a simple, straightforward requirement common in most Western-style democracies.
Well, and this might be a tad bit off topic, but you've been around this politics thing for a long, long time. So let me ask if you could weigh in on an opinion that I personally have. Mark Braden, our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina. I think that the African-American community should be offended by those who assert that African Americans somehow can't get IDs, or as this text case, I can't remember where it was yesterday, but they were saying that they weren't basically smart enough to fill out a ballot. I think that the those who are advocating on behalf of these issues are really painting the African American community in a not so complimentary fashion. And you know, if I were African American, I wouldn't appreciate being, you know, labeled as somebody that doesn't have sense enough to go get an ID.
Well, the trouble with most of this litigation is if you look at it in detail, the people who show up and bring this litigation don't show up with living, breathing human beings who say they can't register and vote. Those never show up in the courtroom. What they have is some type of political science statistics from some professor saying, well, I compared these statistics to these statistics, and it appears this group of the electorate is less likely to have D. It's fantasy land is what it is. This is, as is, you know, the old cliche about there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's statistics. Well, that's what you're talking about in these cases. Most of these cases don't involve some living, breathing human being walking in the courtroom saying, I can't vote because I can't get an ID, because, of course, that person probably had to have an ID to get into the courtroom.
Exactly.
So this is mostly fantasy land. And to be brutally candid with you, most of it's about just politics. The race card, unfortunately, is a common thing that, you know, this is getting close to the election season. So we're going to say that Republicans are racist in the hopes that that will increase the African-American turnout. That's an easy thing to say. It's an unfortunate campaign technique. I mean, there are details to voter ID. Absolutely. One could say, well, you know, if we have a voter ID, we want to make sure that it's reasonably accessible to everyone, and we don't want people who can't afford to get an ID to have one. Maybe you want to make an exception for certain circumstances. There are laws in some states who if it's a Muslim who's offended, who religiously believes that they shouldn't have their picture taken, then, I mean, there are all types of reasonable exceptions that might be appropriate in certain circumstances. But the notion that you wouldn't do it for the 1 in 10 million that would not be able to get it if you really worked at it is crazy. I mean, it's just crazy. Even if you didn't believe in vote fraud, then you should be in favor of this because you want a system not only that's fair, that the winners win and the losers lose, but you want a system where the losers believe the winners won. And part of that is a voter ID system so people are confident in the system. So it doesn't really, even if you didn't have voter fraud that you could deter with this, it would be useful because the people believe it's useful. And the confidence in the system that's instilled by voter ID is worth the price of doing it in and of itself.
Well, very well articulated. And our guest, Mark Braden, here on What Matters in North Carolina, formerly the general counsel for the Republican National Committee. So just one last note on the North Carolina thing. The General Assembly, after passing this legislation in 2013, came back 2 years later and added what's called a reasonable impediment provision, meaning you could basically fill out a form saying, I lost my wallet and don't have an ID, and you could cast a ballot. And then on top of that, you can vote absentee in North Carolina and not show any ID ever. So really the whole suppression thing was really non-existent. And yet, are you concerned, Mark, about judicial activism? I mean, this has a lot of people up in arms. I mean, we're seeing this more and more across the country. And, it's disconcerting.
Well, this decision was an overreach. I don't, I read it and I was astounded by it. I thought it was to equate, these actions, and to say that their intent is racist. There's nothing in the record of the case that indicates this. And so I think that's is an unreasonable decision on the part of the three-judge panel. Absolutely. And I am offended. We really don't need the federal courts micromanaging our election system. Frankly, the people who run our election system ought to run our election system, and we shouldn't be second-guessing in the courts fairly simple, straightforward, logical requirements such as, oh, who's voting? Oh, well, show me your ID. Since nobody seems to think we need to second guess that when we're talking about somebody walking into a federal building or a state office.
Well, it makes you wonder. That's absolutely for sure. Our guest, Mark Braden, we certainly appreciate your being on our program today and your excellent input. The way you represent these issues is really superlative. And by the way, the judges will be setting speed limits in North Carolina pretty soon, so we're looking forward to that. thank you for being our guest, sir, and
okay,
we really appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye. All right, Mark Braden, former general counsel for the Republican National Committee. Winding up what has been an excellent show today. I think we've covered some pretty cool issues, talking about school construction costs and how that impacts lower-wealth counties. They don't have a lot of population, don't have a lot of property tax base. What are you going to do? Should the state come in and dole out millions of dollars to help them renovate, rebuild, or build? Senator Tom McGinnis, first time we've had him on the program, excellent guest, you know, saying that he's not going to stop bringing the issues to the counties that he represents to the General Assembly. He's going to continue to represent his constituents, not necessarily asking for more money, but asking for at least recognition on the part of the General Assembly that there's some real needs in these counties, these what they call Tier 1 counties in North Carolina. If you don't understand that, the Commerce Department, if you're a big affluent-type county, you're a Tier 3, mid-size, middle-range, Tier 2, and then the poorer, rural, lower-population counties are what's called Tier 1, and they use that to factor in various things when they're giving grants and that sort of thing. But very good guests. And go back and listen to that if you missed it. Of course, Representative Nelson Dollar, the chief budget writer in the House, we also got his input at the very beginning of the show on this study that the General Assembly has commissioned about school construction costs and what the needs really are in all 100 of North Carolina's counties. James Shirk from the Heritage Foundation, of course, talked to us about the $15 minimum wage and what that would do realistically, how that would impact the states, and alarmingly said that if we had that mandate here in North Carolina, it would cost 360,000 jobs by 2021. And so, yikes, I don't think we need to think seriously about going down that road anytime soon. Of course, you just heard from Mark Braden. If you missed any of the program, you can always go to freedomactionnetwork.com and download the show as a podcast. You can also find us in the Google Play and iTunes stores. I want to remind you once again that the Civitas President's Club presents Stephen Moore. He is an economist and distinguished visiting fellow from the Heritage Foundation, along with Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, for a luncheon on Tuesday, September 13th. It'll start at 11:30, and it is at the Park Alumni Center, 2450 Alumni Drive in Raleigh. For more information, you can go to nccivitas.org. You don't want to miss that, really. Stephen Moore, he's a distinguished visiting fellow with the Heritage Foundation and is very, very good. So tickets are going fast for that, by the way. So if you have any intention to go, you need to go ahead and register today, nccivitas.org. Tomorrow, we've got a really good program for you scheduled, and always look forward on Thursdays to speaking with our friend Nick Oxner from WBTV. He'll be talking about his latest. And, you know, I joke because it's gotten to where Nick is a little like Mike Wallace used to be with 60 Minutes. You know, people just don't want to see Nick rolling up to their office door. he's done some excellent investigative reporting and is getting quite the reputation in the state as doing an excellent job and somebody who will stay on a story and make sure that, you know, folks are doing what they should be doing, particularly in the public arena. So we look forward every other Thursday to having Nick Oxner. So he'll be our guest tomorrow at 3:35. And then Bob Lupke from the Civitas Institute talking about education, and a couple of surprise guests that I will tell you about tomorrow. As we close the show today, the folks up at Monmouth University have come out with their poll, and it does not look good for Governor McCrory. They have him down by 9 points at this point in time to Roy Cooper, 52-43. So whether or not you put much stock in the Monmouth poll could be cause for concern for Governor McCrory. And anyway, we'll talk more about that tomorrow as well. Find us at freedomactionnetwork.com. This is What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye. And I'm going to Carolina in my mind. Going to Carolina in my mind. In my mind, I'm going to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine? From behind, 'cause I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Gone to Carolina in my mind. And I'm gone to Carolina in my mind.
you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't he just like a friend of mine?